At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Americans have been told for years about a coming gold mine in green energy jobs, and that may be right, but those jobs may be in China. Just 3 years ago, the U.S. was described as the world leader in renewable energy, but China has moved in fast and huge, vastly outspending the U.S., selling to its own huge market, playing hardball. So where's the future now? This hour on Point, we're looking at China's big move on green energy. You can join the conversation. Are we on the way up or out in renewable energy? Have you seen China moving green? How can the U.S. win that future and those jobs? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Lots going on in China. Billions, trillions ultimately to be spent on renewable energy. Here's what's been going on in the U.S. On Friday, Solyndra's executives were brought before Congress to explain their sudden bankruptcy. Despite nearly $500 million in U.S. government loan guarantees, Solyndra executives, including CEO Brian Harrison, chose to plead the fifth to all of the congressional questioning.
I want to ask Mr. Harrison if he thinks the American people who've invested over $500 million deserve to know what happened to that money.
On the advice of my counsel, I invoke the privilege afforded to me by the Fifth Amendment of the Constitution, and I respectfully decline to answer any questions.
I don't understand what's self-incriminating about a yes or no answer as to whether the American people deserve to know what happened to over $500 million of their money.
There's the action in the United States on solar energy, renewable energy, green energy. Let's look to what's happening in China. Joining me first today from Hong Kong is Keith Bradshaw, Hong Kong Bureau Chief for the New York Times. Keith, welcome back to On Point. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me on the show again.
You've written about this. Give us a sense of the scale of China's move into renewable energy and what's driving the Chinese government to be so determined on this front, Keith.
China has gone from being almost a non-player in renewable energy to being the world's dominant power in renewable energy. In each of the past 5 years, they doubled their production of wind turbines. They went from being negligible to being the world's largest installer and the world's largest producer by wide margins of wind turbines. In solar panel production, they went from also essentially zero to now having 54% of the world's output last year, and somewhere you hear numbers of 58% or more of the world's capacity, and they're still building new solar panel factories at an extraordinary pace. Why are the Chinese doing so much? Several reasons. One is it's government policy, for starters. It's in their five-year plans. They have very ambitious targets. Second of all, why did they make it such a clear national priority? Part of it, a lot of it, is worries about energy security. The Chinese government has been very nervous about becoming reliant on imported oil, particularly from volatile countries in the Mideast and Africa. They're not used to the experience of being an energy importer. They were a net energy exporter, a small oil exporter, and also a coal exporter, all the way up until 1993 in the case of oil, and now they're importing about 60% of their oil. They're as dependent as the United States on imported oil, and they really find that a nerve-wracking situation, particularly because their oil is heavily coming in along sea routes controlled by the U.S. Navy. And then on coal, they were a coal exporter all the way up until just 3 years ago, and now they're importing coal as well. So they're very worried about energy security, and they've tended to look towards this heavily subsidized program in renewable energy as a way to at least slow the increase in their dependence on imported energy.
Talk with us, if you would, Keith, about those subsidies and how China is building or has built green energy capacity on such a large scale so quickly. What's the formula? How are they doing it?
Renewable energy tends to rely heavily on the cost of capital. Making wind turbines and making solar panels does not tend to be a very labor-intensive activity. What counts for a lot is how much interest you're having to pay on the money you borrow in order to build the factories and buy the equipment, buy the land, for that matter, underneath the factories. China has a wide variety of policies at the national, provincial, and local levels to help companies afford the equipment they want to buy. I, for example, visited a solar panel factory a year ago in Changsha, in the capital of Hunan province.
Mm-hmm.
And the company there, first of all, it had been allowed to buy its land for one-third of the official price for buying industrial land from the government. What's more is that they had been allowed land at one-third of the industrial price in an area that was close to the heart of the city, across the street from rows of 17-story apartment buildings. The industrial land, in turn, was about a third of the price of residential land in the neighborhood. So right there, they're getting land for one-ninth of the value that you'd otherwise pay for it. They have the ability to resell the land or borrow against it, get mortgages, so they can raise a lot of money that way. They got 20 acres for not that big an operation, several hundred workers. They'd even put in a golf driving range, which is kind of extraordinary to see in the middle of a big, densely packed Chinese city. These subsidies exist at all kinds of different levels. They didn't even have to go to the bank because the bank was under pressure. The local branch of one of the big four national banks in China was under pressure from the central government to be financing renewable energy activities. And so the head of the bank for Changsha had come to them and said, how much can we lend you at the lowest preferred rate, which in turn is slightly below the rate of inflation? And then on top of that, they got various provincial help even on paying that modest interest.
So this is land and loans, Keith, at what sounds like pennies on the dollar or the yuan. If we look overall at the subsidies that the Chinese government, one way and another, and there are many ways, as you say, that it's pouring into renewable energy, what do those numbers look like? I'm looking at one set here. This is from a Fortune magazine conference this year in California, saying that the Chinese government last year poured $120 billion into renewable energy, while the U.S. Invested $20 billion. There's a sort of 6-to-1. Does that sound right to you?
It sounds right. Now, coming up with reliable numbers is very tough because, for example, a big chunk of Chinese money is low interest rate loans from the China Development Bank. Last year alone, I think they did $6 billion to Goldwind, which is a big wind turbine manufacturer, similar sums to Sinovel and a couple of other companies, large companies in the solar and wind sector. How do you count those? How do you add that money up? In the case of the U.S. government, for that matter, a lot of it is loan guarantees. And as Solyndra has shown us, sometimes companies can end up defaulting on the loans, in which case the government actually has to shell out the money for the loan guarantee. But it's very hard adding up these apples and oranges in terms of low-rate loans, discounts on land. So one number is as good as another, but certainly the scale of the Chinese assistance is far, far greater than you see in the United States. And also, it's the way it is structured is also ways that are more likely to raise problems. The Chinese aid is more likely to raise problems with the World Trade Organization rules.
We'll talk about that. So there's subsidy. Then there's also the scale of the market. I mean, the Chinese government is pushing people to get to use renewable energy, and China just has a large economy. They've got a huge market right under their feet. That seems to be a big element here, Keith.
Well, it is, although the situation is very different between wind and solar energy. Why don't we start, first of all, the overall power generation market in China is booming. Even before the U.S. power electricity demand really slowed down with the recession,
mm-hmm.
the forecasts from groups like the International Energy Agency were that China would need to add 8 times as much electricity generation capacity as the United States over the coming 10 or 20 years. That's an enormous difference. In the United States, we've been used to the idea that we're the biggest market. Well, now on energy, on making the equipment for power plants, China is by far the biggest market. Now, how are they meeting that demand? Mostly by building more coal-fired plants. But they've also been building a lot of wind turbines. They are, as I mentioned earlier, the world's largest installer of wind turbines. Beyond that, one of the reasons that they're doing so much in wind is that wind, through the economies of scale of making so many of them, have now gotten down to the point in China where it's only a little bit more expensive than coal. It's somewhat more expensive, I should say. Coal is around 40 fen, per kilowatt hour sold to the grid. And wind energy tends to be in the high 50s, up to 60 fen. So we're still talking up to 50% more. But it used to be considerably more than that. It used to be more like 1 or 150, 100 or 150. So what about solar? Solar, they really have installed very, very little solar energy in China. The Chinese solar industry is by far the world's largest. They're making more solar panels than the rest of the world combined. But virtually all of it is exported. Why? Because the price has been higher. But it is coming down sharply there as well.
So those exports, they've
gone from 400 down to 100 fen to sell electricity in the last 4 years from solar to the grid.
So that's not being installed in China, but it's flooding the world market in solar, and we're seeing American companies falling in response to that, Keith.
American companies are just taking it on the chin. Nobody expected prices to fall this quickly. You look at what the going prices were for solar panels. End of 2008, which after all is a little less than 3 years ago,
yeah.
The price was $3.40 a watt selling solar panels. Now the price is about $1.10.
That's
not a lot of companies that can cope with that.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about China's big move on the world's green, renewable energy future, investing big and playing hardball as the U.S. struggles now to compete. China moving on a huge scale, but it's not all roses. Just earlier this month, hundreds of Chinese villagers stormed a solar panel plant outside of Shanghai over concerns of toxic waste pollution, killing a lot of fish in that area from the factory. Li Ang of Greenpeace China spoke with New Tang Dynasty Television about concerns with China's renewable energy industry.
In China, a lot of manufacturers of solar panels hope to keep their costs down by using relatively out-of-date technology. Doing this is no different to drinking poison when you're thirsty, as it will greatly harm the future development of solar technology.
So there was trouble and people in the streets and really angry, and a rare apology right there. But China's big move into green energy rolls ahead. Keith Bradshaw is with us this hour from Hong Kong. He's bureau chief there for the New York Times, has spent a lot of time covering the renewable energy industry in China. It's big and it is growing fast. Steve Hargreaves joins us right now from New York. He is senior writer for CNNMoney.com, where he covers the American energy industry. Steve Hargreaves, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
We've been hearing Keith describe this boom in renewable energy business in China. What has that meant for renewable energy, green energy in the United States, Steve?
Well, it's meant a lot of things. Some U.S. companies are trying to get in on the boom in China. They're partnering with Chinese firms. They have to partner with Chinese firms as required by Chinese law. But wind turbine maker GE is pretty big in this. And so they're looking at it as a potentially big market. But also, it is having big effects on U.S. companies. As Keith was saying, the price of solar panels down 40% just this year. that, you know, that makes it really hard for U.S. companies to compete in this market.
It seems like every other week or month these days we hear about a major U.S. alternative energy firm going bankrupt.
Yeah, there's no question about it. It's a really difficult market. You know, the electricity situation in the U.S. is much different than it is in China. China is growing massively. Thanks to the recession, the demand for electricity is not growing at all, really, in the U.S. So it's tough for these guys to sell their product. There's very cheap prices for natural gas in the U.S. That's a main competitor for wind power, for solar power. And, you know, this country doesn't have the type of mandates that China does. There is no federal mandate to require utilities to buy renewable power. What we have in the U.S. is a patchwork of state efforts. And that's tough. That's tough for these firms. They have different laws they have to comply with, state to state, even community to community. You know, I was talking to a CEO of a solar panel installer out in California, and he was saying that he spends, you know, literally hours in paperwork for each individual, you know, rooftop that they have to do. And it adds up to millions and millions of dollars. And so it's just all of these guys, you ask them what the number one thing they want in the U.S., and it's a uniform, standardized federal mandate for utilities to buy clean energy.
A mandate to do it. Of course, those come down with frequency in China, not so much here. Looking to exploit the market in China, it's booming. That would be great. On the other hand, that's proven difficult in many instances as well. Here's a little tape. This is from 2009 on New England Cable News. And this is an American-based wind technology company, Massachusetts-based, called American Superconductor, explaining how, this is 2009, their new business partnership in China would help them to get through the recession. And now they're suing those Chinese partners for intellectual property theft. But at that time, here's Daniel McGann, Senior Vice President of American Superconductor.
The base business that we have over in China is enabling new entrants into the wind turbine market. So we take heavy industry companies and we give them the design, and we also work on the supply chain issues with them and really set them up in the business. So if they could make a locomotive engine, they can make a wind turbine with our help.
Sounds great. We can empower them. But now the American Superconductor is bringing suit against Beijing, against China's biggest wind turbine maker, Sinovel Wind Group. Keith Bratcher just mentioned it. And Steve, you must be familiar with this case. They're saying that their key technology ended up stolen by an employee inside and passed to China, Steve.
Right. Well, I mean, that's the danger when you have to partner with, you know, a firm. I mean, it could happen anywhere, not necessarily just China, but, you know, you're partnering with a firm in a foreign country, and part of the requirements for you to gain access to the market is you need to share your technology. And, you know, the danger is there that it's going to get stolen.
So what's going to be left if we can't compete, Keith says, on solar panel production, let's say? China's ramped up wind and got big advantages of scale there. Here was American Superconductor looking to sell the factory equipment to China, and now they've lost that business and they're suing their former Chinese partner. What's left on this table, Steve, for American green energy companies?
Well, there's a lot left. You know, as Keith was saying, the production of solar panels and the production of wind turbines, it's not particularly labor intensive. So, you know, I don't know if we're ever going to compete with China when it comes to a lot of manufacturing processes. But there's a lot more that goes into this than just making the stuff. You know, you have to have people to install it, and you have to have people to sell it. So, you know, these construction jobs, people putting it on rooftops, putting solar panels on rooftops in the U.S., those are largely going to stay here. And then someone's going to figure out how to finance this stuff. And that's where, you know, you talk to people on Wall Street, to fund managers and whatnot, and I've asked them, you know, the same question. You know, how is the U.S. going to win in this market? And they're like, well, the U.S. is very good at figuring out financial solutions to things, you know, probably disregarding what happened in the last couple of years on Wall Street.
Pretty hard to disregard.
Right. But we are very creative, you know, when it comes to financing.
Yeah, but are we going to be installing and selling and financing Chinese products?
That's a real possibility.
Let's bring our listeners in right here. Steve Hargreaves with CNN. Please stand by. Keith Bratcher in Hong Kong. Andy's calling from Framingham, Massachusetts. Andy, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, hi, Tom. One of the guests today have already made several of the points I was going to make. First of all, I was an employee at Evergreen. I was working on the
This is Evergreen Solar, which was based in Massachusetts
Solar.
And went bust.
Yep, and I think there were several reasons, and I think your guests today have already made several of those points. Let me add a couple of things. Last November, before they closed the factory, we were suddenly hit with having to deal with an import tariff because some of the parts that we used in the solar panels were aluminum, and the aluminum came from China. And the U.S. government put an import tariff on Chinese aluminum in order to help protect the U.S. aluminum industry, and thus we were, between getting hammered by Chinese competition, we were also getting hammered by our own government, which sort of was added insult to injury. They were protecting the aluminum industry, but they were doing nothing to help solar against unfair Chinese competition.
So you were right that you were right there, Andy, in the middle of the American solar production industry. Solar exactly. panel production. What are you thinking now? Do you think we're going to see in the future all these green jobs from production of the infrastructure of alternative energy?
I think as far as production of the systems, I think it's too late. We've already lost to the Chinese. I mean, there are so many things that they're doing to corner the market. I mean, they were actually producing panels below cost in order to corner the market on export. I mean, we heard that. We knew that was going on. And, you know, they can do it. They had huge, as your guest said, they had huge government subsidies. There's just no way that a U.S. manufacturer could have competed. When Evergreen built the factory, the economic assumptions were that the prices would be down to $2 a watt in 2013 or 2014. Instead, they, you know, they came down that far, you know, 12 months later.
Too late. We've lost, you say, Andy. That's hard to hear. And I'm sorry, that was your personal experience. It may be our national experience. Let's get another call here from Robert in Boston. Robert, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Oh, thank you very much. I just wanted to make a couple of comments. I run a company that's U.S.-based, but a lot of our engineering is in China. And we're actually being dragged by a lot of our clients to China in a very rapid way. And a lot of that drag, if you will, is for the benefits coming from the Chinese government, which for some reason seems to be taboo in terms of discussion. So, for instance, you know, my clients get benefits where they don't pay for real estate, office space, engineering space for 3 to 7 years in different provinces and regions. The Chinese government pays the resources, the engineering staff around the green technology software space, started back last year in October, the taxes for 3 years to those employees. And they even pay the company's retention bonuses for those employees staying working on green technology jobs. So having to compete with you know, U.S. companies where there's no real estate costs, taxes are paid, and then the retention bonus is paid, it's quite an uneven field.
So, Robert, here you are. You're an American green energy company, but your operations are flooding to China.
Yeah, we've been forced to move there because of our clients. Our clients are actually finding the engineering talent before we do, and so we're being dragged there, if you will. And even though we have some resources here in the U.S., it's continuing to grow at an unbelievable pace, not only in China but in Taiwan and Singapore and Malaysia. We're literally being, you know, dragged from our clients wanting to work and also service that market.
Yep, being dragged there, Robert. We've got it. Being dragged there while the U.S. is. Squabbling over Solyndra and what happened there, Chinese at a much higher scale of subsidy and just roaring ahead. Keith Bradshaw, Steve Hargreaves, please stand by. I want to bring into our conversation from San Francisco, Josh Fried. He's vice president for the Clean Energy Program at Third Way. It's a D.C.-based energy think tank. Josh Fried, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Yeah, you hear, we open the phone lines and right away we've got people right out of the heart of the American green energy business. And the very first one to come on says, too late, we've lost, it's China's. What do you say?
Well, it's not necessarily China's yet, particularly on every technology, but it is understandable that there's real concern and frustration here. The Chinese are doing more than subsidies and potentially illegal trade practices or stealing IP. They're also
intellectual property and technology. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yes. They're also putting smart policies in place for whatever reason. So, as your previous callers alluded to, there's demand in China because they are moving to put a price on carbon so that conventional energy like coal or natural gas is going to cost more because there is going to be a cost associated with the pollution they put out. They are also charging a little bit extra for electricity and using the money for that to help pay for solar and wind. And they are also investing the money, both from the government and also through inexpensive private capital, in the kind of innovations that we're going to need to develop the next generation of renewables.
If they win this industry, Josh, if they win the bulk of it, dominance in it, what does that mean for the future of the U.S. economy?
Well, it's a potentially $2.3 trillion or larger market. That's about 15% of America's GDP. It means that jobs that would have been here are going to be in China instead, most of them, and we'll be buying products that are owned, operated, and maintained by the Chinese. And it doesn't matter which country it is. It's that throughout our history, the U.S. has been the country that figures these technologies out first or figures out the economic potential for them and creates the sectors here. That's what created the American economic century.
Keith Bradshaw, what are you thinking as you watch there from the coast of China? The rest of the world, the U.S. in particular, should have grappled with China's big push. Is our first caller correct? Is it too late? You know, the U.S. has lost. They've won. Game over?
It's very tough for other countries to compete with China. The one tricky aspect of what China has done is that the number of buy Chinese policies has been extensive. For example, in 2006, the government put out a policy saying if you want to sell a turbine in China, it has to be at least 70% manufactured in China. Now, there's practically no other country that has done that, or some of them did that prior to the creation of the WTO in 1993, but the WTO banned that. But nobody really complained about it, and so everybody moved their operations very quickly to China. A lot of the wind turbine manufacturers have been thinking about moving to China anyway to push down costs, and so the industry shifted to China at a rapid rate. The Obama administration ended up complaining about that in the autumn of 2009, and the Chinese removed the policy and strongly object to any other country now introducing a similar policy. But during the time that they had the policy, it was highly effective in persuading companies to transfer operations and technology to China. So the trade policies have been absolutely central to all of this, and they have been very carefully and skillfully and successfully applied.
You know, Josh, there's a big debate in this country about how much the government should be involved in helping new industries get going. Here's maybe example number one. But you still got resistance to the government getting in here. People are all over the Solyndra investment. Now, it went badly, but of course, sometimes things do go badly when you're putting risk capital out there on new industries. But here's a view from the Heritage Foundation in Washington, and David Kreutzer there, energy economist there, quoted recently saying, you know, that if the Chinese want to subsidize all this, if they want to provide the world with below-cost solar panels, let them. He says that's not a strategy that's likely to end well. Is it possible this is good for everybody else, good for the United States, Josh, that they're going to subsidize low-cost green energy for the rest of the world? Could it be good for the rest of the planet?
Well, subsidizing certain technologies could be good. We've seen that in electronics and other sectors where cheaper production has resulted in the U.S. having access to newer and more types of technologies at an affordable cost. But what we're having here is different. The Heritage Foundation is suffering from historical amnesia. Throughout the country's history since at least the 1860s, the U.S. government has partnered with the private sector to conduct the research and development and help deploy technologies that at their early stages were unproven, too risky, or too expensive to deploy. It got us the railroad, it got us commercial aviation, satellite technology, the internet, the list goes on and on. What we're having today is, for whatever reason, one party and one ideology, conservatives and Republicans, and unfortunately too many cases, that have decided now, in 2011, it is time to stop the successful partnership the government has had with the private sector. And they're choosing it at a time when competition globally
for the emerging $2.3 trillion is at its height.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about China's big move on the world's green renewable energy future, investing big and playing hardball as the U.S. struggles to compete. With us this hour from Hong Kong, Keith Bradshaw, bureau chief there for the New York Times. He spent a lot of time covering the alternative energy, renewable energy business in China. It is enormous, exploding in size, and just in these last few years, just in 3 years or so since the U.S. was described as dominant in some of these sectors. Not now. Steve Hargreaves is with us from New York with CNNMoney.com, covers that business here in the United States. And Josh Fried is with us from the Third Way, energy consulting firm or think tank based in Washington. Let's go to Tom in Brattleboro, Vermont. Tom, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi, Tom. Well, first of all, we gave it all away under Nixon because he invited everybody over for a free look. But Reagan killed the tax credit program for solar energy, and we need to not forget that. When I left Saudi Arabia in 1983, the whole Rubicali, which is the empty desert of Saudi Arabia, was entirely acres and miles of solar power that they were taking advantage of. You know, what do we do to recycle what we have? It is, to me, we lost it because of our greed and our stupidity while the rest of the country ran with it. And I definitely blame both Reagan and Nixon for killing a lot of this, and the countries that sprang to it did, and we have done nothing.
Well, and then that's going way back. The fight goes on today. Josh Fried, we've got a lot of people. Thank you, Tom. A lot of people along this line online. Duke says the problem in the U.S. is simply that Republicans, fed by big money from fossil fuels company, have been resisting alternative energy for decades. Ron says, you know, why are renewables not more vibrant here? Because our government officials are owned by the fossil fuel industry. Then they work against any help for renewables, such as updating the grid to welcome more renewables. What about American policy, Josh?
Well, America policy right now, unfortunately, is paralyzed, and it's not just on clean energy, though I think given the stakes, it's one of the biggest challenges. And if you look at countries around the rest of the world, even China is putting a price on carbon. We heard 2 years ago from Republicans when there was the debate about cap and trade, which would have put a price on carbon pollution in the United States. The U.S. can't do that because China would never put such a policy in place and we'd be at a competitive disadvantage. Well, we didn't do it. China is now moving ahead and they are going to be at an even greater competitive advantage with this. Energy policy here has never been well thought out. It's never looked ahead and had the kind of business plan that we hear across the energy sector that companies need so that they can purchase new technologies and build the expensive long-term equipment they need to, whether it's generate electricity or build a car that is used on a technology that they know will be around in 5 to 10 years.
Keith Bradshaw, let me ask you, here's another listener online. Looks like Jason says renewable energy is not close to being cost competitive and ready for mission critical deployment. Furthermore, he writes, unlike fossil fuels, China cannot corner the market because the U.S. can always ramp up production of renewables if and when they do become truly cost effective. How does that strike you there in Hong Kong, Keith?
Two separate questions. First question, is it cost competitive now with fossil fuels? In most places, it is not. And just to give one more time the example of what what the grid is paying for electricity in China, it's paying 40 Chinese cents per kilowatt hour from coal. It's paying 55 to 60 Chinese cents per kilowatt hour to buy electricity from wind. And it's paying 100 to 110 Chinese cents to buy it from solar. So it does still cost more unless you're in some incredibly remote area where it's going to cost so much to build the transmission towers there, or maybe it's a mobile application like you need to have it in some place that moves around, such as a military encampment. But short of those locations, then wind and solar are not really cost-effective yet.
So describe to us around that point, Keith, why exactly then do Chinese enterprises or consumers buy this? Are they forced to buy it anyway at the higher price by the government? How does it work?
Well, it's two separate questions. On wind, the Chinese utilities have bought it and installed it on a large scale because they are forced to do so by the government, and then there is a tax on users of electricity. It's higher for industrial users than for residential users, and that tax is used to compensate the utilities for the extra cost that they incur from generating part of their electricity from wind. For solar, however, it's a whole different ballgame. Because China installs virtually no solar, the solar market is all about China exporting solar panels to particularly Germany, Spain, the United States, countries that have subsidies for consumers to install solar panels.
Mm-hmm.
So the solar industry is more about Chinese companies tapping into Western subsidies for the installation of solar power in the interests of reducing emissions and so forth.
And what about... I'm sorry. Please go ahead.
Well, then, to move on to, I guess, his second question.
Yeah, that the U.S. can always ramp up and get in if it becomes cost-effective.
Well, that is one of the questions here. And that said, it's very difficult to set up a large industry from scratch. You have a variety of suppliers. That's certainly true in a wind turbine, where you may have several hundred suppliers. To try to set up a whole industry from scratch, how are you going to do it when you're competing against an industry that already has very large economies of scale, that has a lot of government backing? It could conceivably be done down the road if somebody really, really wants to invest a lot of money, but it's a very risky proposition, and you don't tend to see people starting industries from scratch, big companies from scratch in industries that they're not already in. Once an industry leaves a country, you don't often see it come back. For example, we now have a lot of demand in the United States for DVD players.
Mm-hmm.
Or for laptop computers and so forth. I used to live in North Carolina. I went to university in North Carolina. I can remember in Central North Carolina when IBM said that they didn't want to expand any more in the Research Triangle Park in Central North Carolina, the Raleigh-Durham-Chapel Hill area, because they already employed such a large share of the workforce that they didn't want to become more dominant in the local economy. I think it was, but that was in the days when personal computers were made in North Carolina.
Mm.
Now that production is almost entirely moved to China or elsewhere in East Asia, and it's hard to imagine somebody setting up from scratch a personal computer industry in the United States, even though practically everybody buys personal computers now.
Steve Hargreaves, let me come to you in New York. What about our listener's case, assertion here that, hey, you know, it's not so bad when renewable energies, green energies, are sort of one-to-one on par in cost with fossil fuels, then the U.S. can jump in and ramp up production and still win. What do you say, Steve?
Right. It's known as the possum theory. The U.S. is playing dead until this stuff actually works.
Cool.
I'm not sure I buy it either. I think, you know, whoever the companies that invent this stuff, the companies that really that make it work, they're going to hold the patents to this. And if it's, you know, if it's the Chinese companies that are doing the research now, then it's going to be they're going to be the beneficiaries of it.
Josh, what do you think are the implications if that's the way it goes? If China owns it now and owns the production of these elements of green energy down the road, what does it mean for the U.S.? I mean, we don't make DVDs here. There's a lot of things we don't make here. On the green energy front, what are the implications or consequences? Does it matter?
Well, it matters a lot. I mean, one of the challenges is that innovation, as I'm here out in Silicon Valley this week, and one of the things they say, innovation happens oftentimes on the factory floor. So it's not just the current generation of technologies. It's the next generation and the next generation after that. And it means not only fewer jobs manufacturing products, but it also means the companies that own the technology and that are selling them and the revenues that are being generated from them all go overseas rather than in the United States. And Ronald Reagan even recognize this. In the 1980s, he saw the semiconductor industry really blossoming in the United States and realized there was a strategic and economic imperative for keeping it here. And so he, working with Congress, put policies in place to ensure that an American semiconductor industry stayed domestic. We have the opposite happening right now with Republicans in Congress who are really rushing to destroy policies set up to create the next generation electric battery, much more efficient, cost-effective solar, wind, and technologies we haven't even thought of yet, and basically force these companies and these innovators overseas because there's no capital here and there's no policies here. And that's going to mean a lot of Americans 30, 40 years ago may be looking to China and to other countries to get jobs and create new companies because there's not a domestic market here, and that would be devastating.
30, 40 years from now. Joy in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Thanks for calling, Joy. You're on the air.
Hi there. So I'm calling about the ecological implications. It wasn't just fish that were injured in that spill in China. There were people and houses and farmland destroyed.
This is where where the villagers went on kind of a rampage saying, stop this.
Rampage and busted up the factory, that's right. And what people don't realize is that solar is clean if it is manufactured right, but the modern thin-film solar depends on cadmium compounds, and any solar generally uses just plain old PVC for the matrix that the cells are embedded in, and often these are used in gaseous form or liquid, and they really infiltrate badly if they're handled badly.
So what does that say to you, Joy? Are you then just as happy that it's being made in China and not here because it's dirty?
That says to me that as a U.S. citizen, our tax money should not be subsidizing filthy construction, and we may not be able to say that things have to be made in the U.S., but we certainly can say they have to be made up to a certain ecological standard, because it is quite possible to recapture these elements if we use the right manufacturing. It just doesn't work right if it's done as cheaply and carelessly as possible, which is what is happening in far too much of China. It's a hidden ecological subsidy. And we should be willing to pay enough to not poison either ourselves or the Chinese. And that can come from the state. That can come from local governments like cities that say we will not subsidize things that are not manufactured cleanly. Individual citizens can say, I want to know how and where my panels are made, and they honestly should.
Well, I take your point loud and clear, but Keith Bradshaw, it's hard to make the argument when the environmental damage occurs somewhere else. When it occurs in China, we hear about it in a news story here and there. We don't see it going on, year after year. I mean, is China focused on cleaning up its own industry around this? Can you really see this as an argument that will fly in the U.S. for subsidizing and regulating solar infrastructure production, Keith?
The Chinese have been trying to clean up a lot of industries, but the problem you get is that the main pressure for cleaning up industries tends to come from Beijing. By contrast, the local and provincial governments are still measured in terms of their effectiveness, mainly in terms of how fast they can increase GDP growth. And now also there's a little box to tick in terms of, are you doing a good job of supporting green energy? So they don't have the same level of interest or commitment to environmental preservation. So that said, you could make an argument that by having this industry move to China, that the U.S. is getting access to, it's a cynical argument maybe, but that the U.S. Is getting access to inexpensive renewable energy materials while the environmental damage is not taking place on U.S. shores. On the other hand, you can make these things in clean ways. It does happen in the United States. So in terms of a sort of a global sense, it's not good. But, I mean, you can even take the Heritage Foundation argument that maybe China is making a mistake here. And if you want, I can follow up on that.
Yeah.
But just briefly, the Chinese could yet get caught off base here. The scenario in which the Chinese get in trouble here would be one in which, first of all, the world decides it's not going to worry about global warming, maybe because it's concerned with financial crises or whatever, and therefore you see a disappearance of subsidies or renewable energy mandates in the West. If the West were to stop subsidizing any form of solar and just turn its back on solar. And if the West were to not require utilities to have any preference whatsoever for installing wind and solar and just go with coal, that would be a blow to the Chinese industry. Similarly, if you were to see a rapid adoption of coal or maybe a move to reduce some of the environmental and pollution restrictions on coal, if you were to see very large increases in oil production, whether it's from the Middle East or maybe from new fields that are being discovered off places like Brazil, there is a scenario in which the Chinese might find themselves with massive investments in renewable energy without huge markets. However, those scenarios are not necessarily ones that people want to embrace in terms of the consequences for energy security or the consequences for global warming.
Josh Fried, that makes it sound as though China's lined up with the kind of future that most people, I think, hope for, which is not sort of a what the hell, let the fossil fuels flow forever, let the, you know, let the warming go on. But do you see a kind of a drill baby drill future in which China fails and the U.S. wins because the world walks away from trying to reduce carbon output, Josh?
Well, you heard the I think you heard the doubt in Keith's voice even as he was spinning that scenario. And look, we've talked to folks in Germany, in the United Kingdom, in China. There are a number of reasons why countries around the world are moving away from coal and oil and natural gas, even to some extent, and towards clean energy sources. Oftentimes, it has less to do with climate than energy security and concerns about how they're going to generate electricity in their own country. That's why China's doing this. They have a long track record over the last 10 years now of enormous rates of growth, and they need to maintain a certain rate of growth to continue to pull their population out of poverty and into the middle class. We could have said the same thing 10 or 15 years ago to preserve the typewriter industry or the fax industry, longer ago preserve cars. And a lot of times we've had people who were naysayers. Too often they've proven wrong.
And we've seen where those industries have gone. Now we're staring right at green energy and where it's going in the world. This is a great perspective for us as we listen to all the debates in this country over Solyndra and everything else. And we're grateful to the three of you for helping us grab it. Steve Hargreaves with CNNMoney.com in New York. Steve, I want to thank you for being with us today. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Tom.
Josh Fried with the Third Way Clean Energy Program based out of Washington. Thank you for being here, Josh.
Thanks, Tom.
And Keith Bradshaw, Hong Kong Bureau Chief for the New York Times. Your insights are always terrific. We appreciate your reporting and your time today, Keith. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Listeners, thank you for being here. This is On Point.